Consolidated Proceedings in Healds versus Saltier, and the other is Marriage of Moore. Are counsel checked in both of those cases?
Yes.
Okay, I see we have experienced counsel in the first case. Have both of you received our written statement of directions?
Yes.
Does either of you have any questions?
The only question I had was, since we have appeal and another appeal consolidated, we're still at the total of 15 minutes, is my understanding, is that correct?
Yes. If anyone in the audience has a cell phone or similar device, would you please turn it off? Otherwise, we're ready for argument in Saltier versus Healds.
Good afternoon. I'm Wendell Porterfield, attorney registration number 5881, appearing on behalf of Saltier Development and Gordon Blakey. This is a case, as the court is aware from having read the briefs, that deals with the relationship between a general contractor and two individuals who had that general contractor build a house. Contract was entered into in August of 2003, called for substantial completion to be achieved by July 2004, a date which was met. The parties' relationship was fundamentally sound and good until the conclusion of the project. The court found with record support that the parties did not follow in large part the provisions of the contract relating to payment. The parties did not relate in large part to provisions having to do with change orders. And the court found with record support that each party had expectations of the other that were not incorporated into the contract. Following a bench trial, the court sorted through the facts and entered judgment on certain claims in favor of Saltier and on certain other claims in favor of the Heels, the property owners. With respect to the contract, the mechanics lien claim asserted by Saltier, the court found that it was unable to determine with specificity what was unpaid without having the benefit of a forensic analysis. And our contention is that because of the documents that were submitted into the record, all of the invoices, all of the statements, all of the backup, that there was sufficient information for the court to make that determination. The practice in the Fifth Judicial District is that if you object to any proposed exhibits, you must state your objection. In this case, both the general contractor and the homeowners listed and did not object to the introduction of the billing records. This was a case where the court found that the parties did not follow the billing as spelled out in the contract. The contract, in a typical fashion, called for payments to be made to the general contractor who would then pay subs. In this case, there was a request made by the property owners, and the general contractor submitted what were called invoices and valuations. And the invoices reflected what were owed particularly to the general contractor, while the valuations listed what was owed to everyone on the job. The property owners then took those records and made payments in some cases to themselves, in some cases to parties that they had subcontracted with directly, and in some cases to Saltier.
Pardon me for interrupting, if I may, Mr. Porterfield, but
yes.
Would you please address the trial court's concern that some of these records were confusing and it didn't have a clear understanding from looking at these records of just what was owed?
It wasn't so much a basis as to what is owed. The mechanics lien claim is a claim that I have provided goods, services, and material which is incorporated into your property. And you don't need to go back and determine with specificity exactly what was paid and what was unpaid if at the end of the day you can come up with a balance that is unpaid. Now, it would be one thing for the court to say, I do not believe your evidence. It would be one thing for the court to say that you have billed in a manner that's not consistent with the contract. But here, the court had the billing records in front of it which matched to the penny what Saltire was asking for, as that was explained at trial. So it's not a question. I mean, the Heels did not object to the billing records being introduced. They did not say that they were confusing. And given those circumstances, I believe that it was error for the court to rule that it didn't have specific information with which to make the determination. The second point that I wish to address was the court's introduction of what was marked as Exhibit 546 by the defendants. The defendants had listed an individual as an expert witness to testify with respect to an estimate they received to replace windows in their home that they contended had been damaged as a result of a final construction claim. Under Rule 26, the person from Alpine Glass and Mirror was listed as an expert to come in and to testify with respect to the estimate he had given. During the trial, someone else appeared, and on the day before that person appeared, it was actually represented that the person who prepared the estimate would be present to testify with respect to that estimate the next day. That person did not appear. The person who from Alpine who was called had no idea how the record was created. He thought perhaps it had been created by a prior general manager. He had never been in the home. He had never inspected the windows itself. But notwithstanding that, the court allowed the estimate to come in under the business record exception to the hearsay rule. And as I explained earlier, under the practice in the Fifth Judicial District, if you object to introduction of an exhibit, you must do so before trial, and Saltire objected to the introduction of that exhibit on the basis that it was hearsay. Nevertheless, without any foundation from anyone who could testify as to how that record was truly created, it was allowed to be introduced under the business records exception, and it became the sole basis for awarding damages with respect to those windows, because the Heels themselves had in fact never had the windows replaced. They had never paid anyone to do that. And the estimate was a compilation, it appears, of both labor and materials. And there was no opportunity to cross-examine with respect to that document. And therefore, Saltire contends that it was erroneous for the court to admit that under the business records exception. So
the authenticating witness couldn't even describe the process consistent with Alpine Glass's normal procedures as to how you would derive such an estimate?
He had never been in the house. He didn't know who had prepared it. He didn't know what was done. There was no raw data to suggest what windows were measured or anything else. We just had an estimate. That was all.
And the estimate doesn't enumerate the windows that are...
It enumerates certain windows, but it doesn't go through the methodology of what kind of window was it. Is it the same type of glass that's being replaced as the glass that was there? It was necessary for someone to lay a foundation. I'm not saying that it would be impossible to get that document in, but it was erroneous to introduce it under the business records exception.
Thank you.
The court also found that there had been, the court, these are addressed in the brief, with respect to negligent misrepresentation, the court found that Saltire breached a duty to fairly represent its business practices to the Heels. And based upon that, it awarded nominal damages of $1,000. Now, nominal damages are, to my understanding, $1, not $1,000. It is an element of the tort of negligent misrepresentation that the party suffer actual damages. And here, there were no actual damages. The court sort of went and said, I think you may have done something wrong, so it appears that the court just decided to award some figure that had no basis in fact. There were no allegations with respect to actual damages with respect to negligent misrepresentation. And I also question whether this was a business, which is also a requirement for the tort of negligent misrepresentation.
Pardon me, Mr. Porterfield, if I may ask you a question about what you just said. Going back to the tort of negligent misrepresentation and that concept of nominal damages, putting aside for a moment whether nominal damages would be available for a tort of negligence, is it, when you take a look at both the court's original written order and then its Rule 59, is it reasonable to look at the court's use of the word nominal and look at that word and say, well, what the court was doing was not making a specific reference to a term of art, i.e. nominal in the contract, breach of contract sense, but nominal as in small?
I think that nominal damages is a term of art. And when I see the word nominal damages, I have to assume that that's what the court meant, that I'm going to award, that I can't find any specific amount of damages, and therefore I'm going to award nominal damages. But I think even if I say I'm just going to give you a small amount, a small award of damages, that begs the question, because the tort itself requires that there be actual damages. With respect to...
Counsel, can I ask you a couple of questions about negligence? Not the misrepresentation claim, but the negligent hiring and comparative negligence claims in this case.
And with respect to Diamond Kipps?
Yeah.
The issue there, I believe, is one of who's ultimately responsible. The court, there was a great deal of testimony with respect to who actually hired Diamond Kipps. Eventually, Mr. Heels, I believe, in the record, indicated that he did sign the proposal that had been submitted by Diamond Kipps. Now, in the brief from the Heels, there are statements that that was a contractual requirement to do that cleaning. I believe that's an overstatement. The cleaning reference in the contract has to do with keeping the house clean. But nevertheless, the contract or the proposal was submitted to the homeowners, and it contained a disclaimer. The cleaner said, I'm not going to be responsible for any damage that may result from cleaning the windows. The Heels nevertheless accepted that and seek to hold Saltire responsible for that damage.
Well, starting with the negligent hiring claim, isn't it required to have an employer-employee relationship? And aren't we missing one in this case?
I'm not certain that the court got it exactly right as to why that party was responsible. I don't believe that Saltire was responsible for the acts of Diamond Kipps because it didn't hire Diamond Kipps. And the proximate cause was not grit on the windows. The grit could have been removed, perhaps at a greater cost. And if someone came in and said, for $4,000, I'll remove it, but you have to release me, but for $15,000, I will make sure all of that's off, perhaps the court could have found a way to award that as damages. But here there was a specific release from the property owner of the person doing the work, and the court found that the general contractor couldn't be responsible for the acts of that person, particularly when there had been a release. Two other points I'd like to make quickly. One is with respect to interest. I understand the Wagon Master case suggests that my argument with respect to interest is wrong. I can't glean enough facts from the Wagon Master case to see if it really applies, because in the case here that's been submitted, we have different awards for different amounts. We have contract damages, we have tort damages, we have mechanics lien, which provides for interest at 12%, we have the contract that provides for interest at 18%. Now, the Wagon Master case says if you have varying awards growing out of the same transaction, you're going to net the award and then apply interest from that date forward. The court didn't do that. The court kind of waffled here in awarding interest back and forth, and its last interest award was I believe, done after the court lost jurisdiction. It no longer had jurisdiction to change the interest or the amount of the net judgment because it was done well after the time when it could have done that. I filed a Rule 59 motion. The court denied that. Then there were some issues with respect to attorney fees, and then the court entered a supplementing final judgment, and I think it had lost its jurisdiction to determine the net amount of the judgment. But in any event, the court ultimately awarded the Heels prejudgment interest, and I think under the Goodyear Homes case, they don't get that. They never had any of the work done. And that if anything, the court should net the award and apply statutory interest from that time forward. And in my last 5 seconds, the only thing about the Colorado Consumer Protection Act is that I asked the court to make a specific ruling and the court didn't, even though the court found that there was no evidence introduced to meet the standards of cases from the state Supreme Court saying there must be a public impact. And I see my time is up. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is James Bain. I represent the Appley Cross Appellants. I'm sure the panel well recognizes that this appeal concerns a contract between an experienced home builder and inexperienced homeowners. Because of that lack of experience, the Heels negotiated a contract with the homeowner, with the home builder, in which they had three protections. The first protection was they would only have to pay for the actual cost of construction plus a 10% fee. They also had a provision in there that they would not, the budget would not be increased by line item more than 5% without their approval. And finally, that there would have to be change orders in order to increase the contract price. The other issue is that the court found that there was misrepresentation. The court, as Mr. Porterfield indicated, only indicated nominal damages. I think the evidence demonstrates that there was that misrepresentation was supported by actual damages. The contract in many places only indicates that the Heels were responsible to pay actual cost plus 10%. In the framing item, which I'd like to discuss first, the court allowed Saltier to recover $114,200 that it billed. The court also recognized that Saltier, in fact, had actual costs far less than that. So for three independent reasons, we would seek to have that decision overturned. One, it was based on misrepresentations, which caused the damage. Two, the court misconstrued the contract. And three, Mr. Blakey's judicial admission should be binding. Turning to the misrepresentation claim first, the court found in favor of the Heels on the misrepresentation claim. The court found that Saltier misrepresented material facts relevant to the labor pricing. The court found that it breached its duty to reveal material facts and that it withheld information. In specific, Mr. Blakey, who was the president of Saltier, represented that Saltier had employees. He later testified repeatedly they did not. He indicated that those employees were paid at the Exhibit D to the contract rates. He also had Exhibit D attached to the contract. In fact, Saltier paid far lower rates. The Heels justifiably relied on that. Based on those statements, Exhibit D was attached to the contract.
So is the $114,000 what was billed on the basis of the Exhibit D rates, and there was a lesser amount if the labor had been charged for what Saltier actually paid?
Not exactly, Your Honor. The billed amounts was billed as if there was a Saltier had a subcontract with itself, which the court rejected, but recognized that was how Saltier billed it. The court, however, calculated the amount of labor for framing that Saltair was entitled based on the hourly summary times that Exhibit D rates.
And what number is that?
That's more than $114,000.
Okay, and what's the actual?
$140,000.
Okay, what's the labor expense if charge if only Saltair only recovers what he actually paid the people?
The court calculated about $55,000 based on actual cost.
So is your damage claim for the negligent misrepresentation then $114 less $55?
Plus the 10% fee that they had to pay, so it's about $65,000.
Okay, thank you.
And that is indeed the damages claim, the misrepresentation caused those damages because the misrepresentations led to Exhibit D becoming part of the contract, which never would have been otherwise. And that was the foundation, as I tried to explain, to how the court calculated those damages. But they were limited, as I tried to explain, by the amount that it was billed, because it billed as if it had an allegorical contract with itself. The other issue is that Mr. Blakey made all of those misrepresentations. No one else spoke for Saltair. So he should be personally liable for his personal actions. Just because he acted in a representative capacity doesn't exonerate him for what he did individually. I'd also say, Your Honor, that the court misconstrued the contract for a number of reasons. First of all, the contract as a whole limited the recovery to actual cost. 6A said that in the contract. That provision also eliminated cash discounts, which reveal the party's intent to only pay what the actual cost expended was plus the fee.
And actual cost would be what Saltair pays the subs or what it actually pays its employees.
Exactly. Exactly. The contract also required invoices. Contracts section 6B3 little I's required invoices at least. Contract section 11 required complete and accurate records compiled in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles. There really can't be any ambiguity as to what actual cost means. It means what you spent. On the framing, there was never any invoices provided because Saltair built as if it had a fixed contract with itself. If you also look at what happened before there was a dispute, which is typically looked at for construing contracts, Saltair didn't bill in accordance with Exhibit D. It billed as if it had a contract with itself. It didn't treat these workers as subcontractors. It gave 1099s instead of W-2s. It didn't withhold taxes. It didn't withhold Social Security. And it didn't bill in accordance with that, which is really the bottom line. And finally, the third reason is Mr. Blakey repeatedly, as the court found, testified they had no employees. So to calculate it based on the employee rate was not appropriate.
I mean, why does that really matter, though? I mean, the amount he actually paid these people, whether it was on 1099s or W-2s, is determinable, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, and he's not entitled to anything more than what he actually paid him plus 10%.
I couldn't agree more.
So what difference does it make whether he called them employees or whether the court came to a different conclusion?
I agree.
Okay.
As far as the Stone overcharges go, that also, and the Stone was the basis for the lien claim. The lien claim, $35,000 that the court awarded, was based on Stone. In order to get there, you have to disregard the three contract protections for the HEALs, the homeowners.
Well, counsel, let me ask you a question about that. Didn't the court make findings that there were verbal change orders that the parties had agreed orally to some changes, and that's what generated the additional costs that went above and beyond what the contract had said in writing?
That's true. There were oral agreements to change orders, but not in regard to Stone. Mr. Blakey, as set forth in my brief, specifically said he never told the Heels about the exterior stone increases. There was discussion about interior stone, not exterior stone. So the exterior stone, we finally got the stone invoices in discovery, and they were $32,000 less than the amount charged. So that was the actual cost. In addition, the stone...
And that's paid to a stonework subcontractor?
Yes, sir.
Okay, all labor and materials just paid to the sub?
Yes, sir. Exhibits that we got in discovery and we introduced into evidence because it showed that they were overcharging for stone. It also exceeded the 5% limit on the budget. And there was no change order discussed whatsoever in connection with stone. I'd also like to discuss the attorney fee provision. Contract section 14B provides if any action, not claim, action is brought by either party concerning the contract, the prevailing party is entitled to its reasonable attorney's fees. Despite that very broad language, the court reduced the amount that the Heels paid by 85%. So they only gave them, the court gave them 1/7 of the amount that they paid. The reason I say they misconstrued the contract is because that language is very broad. Saltier brought this action, not this claim. Action would lead me to believe that that is all of the expenses incurred in the action, because that's what it says. Concerning the contract, very broad language also. No ambiguity there. And reasonable attorney's fees. Again, there's, as all of the judges know, it's been well discussed as far as you have to go through the whole array of factors in Hartman versus Friedman, the Lodestar. None of that was done. It was an arbitrary 1/7 of the amount awarded by the court. In addition, the Heels attorney submitted an affidavit. The affidavit that said essentially all of the time was spent in connection with the contract claims. All of the time was inexplicably intertwined with that. But the court apparently overlooked that affidavit. In fact, in its ruling, it said the parties didn't submit a proration allocating between the contract claims and the non-contract claims. Clearly, as I cited in my papers, we submitted an affidavit. The court, because it missed that affidavit, came up with its own arbitrary formula. And I say arbitrary because the court didn't consider how much time was spent in connection with the contract. Rather, it assumed that the time was equally allocated among the seven claims that the Heels submitted, which was disputed by the undisputed evidence, by the affidavit. The court, by only considering the seven claims that the Heels submitted, ignored the fact that the Heels had to defend against the Saltier claim, which was, by the way, a breach of contract, an unjust enrichment, and lien, all concerning the contract. So, as I cited in my papers, formulas do not determine what reasonable fees are. You have to actually go through the effort of determining what fees were incurred for what was reasonable. Was the rates reasonable? Was the time reasonable? None of that was done. It was divided by seven, and it wasn't even done. That would not be a proper way to allocate fees. The U.S. Supreme Court in Hensley went through all of the problems in having such a formula for fees. And it's clear in all of the Colorado cases, the fees must be reasonable. The court should consider the factors in 1.5, the rules of professional conduct. It should consider the Lodestar as a basis, at least to start with.
Counsel, I understand your argument on the attorney's fees, both as you're presenting it now and as it was briefed. So I want to move along just a little bit.
Okay.
Your counterpart talked about the CCPA and pointed out that you did not prevail on that claim and that they were seeking a determination of fees and costs.
Yes, sir.
And that the trial court did not rule on that. Can you address that?
Yes, sir. Well, first of all, as I put in our opening brief, there was substantial evidence on the public impact. But setting that aside, because the court ruled that there wasn't, Saltier asked for attorney's fees under the CCPA, and the court didn't grant it. I would say that the court then denied it so that there was no support for the CCPA claim.
So implicitly denied it, is your argument?
Yes, sir. Exactly. So we would request that you remand this matter for a number of items with directions. One, that there be findings of fact on the attorney's fees. Two, that the court enforce the three contract protections, actual cost, 5% limit on budget items, and change order provisions. That the court award actual damages for the misrepresentation and for the array of other items that I've discussed in both of my briefs, but didn't have time to address here. Any other questions? Thank you.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case